This is Mike Allen's Nightline on LBC News Talk 97.3 FM. Call Mike now on 071 973 9733.
Welcome to authoress Hilga Jihadi. Hello, nicely to have you with us today.
Hello.
And last week I mentioned on a trailer for the programme an opportunity to meet the woman who met Adolf Hitler. And of course, this actually happened to you as a young girl. What an extraordinary set of circumstances. You've written a book which, I must be honest, when people skim read a book, as I sometimes have to do for a living, because you just can't sit down and read it dot to dot. I just couldn't do it. I had to read it. And I sat and read about three and a half hours today, welded to this book. I couldn't finish it, no. Yeah. I mean, I had to speed read the second part, because otherwise I just wouldn't have had the whole picture. But I was entranced, because here was a personal view of a life, a family, and people affected by this turmoil. But it was very personal. There weren't any dramatics in it. It wasn't full of people dashing off and doing anything. It was just people affected by what had been happening around them. And I got the impression that there was, that part of Germany or in East Prussia, Königsberg, was almost a quiet island for a lot of this. Because I got the impression, reading the book, up until about 43, 44, although there were hostilities going on and you stood your ground as a Swiss citizen and refused to put your hand up to say hi to Hitler at school and things like that, that the area was a little bit unaffected. Was that largely, was that true, or was that, did I misread that?
No, I don't think you misread that, because I think it was because we were so far in the east. Mm. Things weren't as strict as in the main part of Germany. Although we had the Hitler Youth, because you see, the law, Hitler's law was, as soon as you are 10 years old, you have to join the Hitler Youth. Mm. And because I was Swiss, I didn't. But I could observe what happened. And quite honestly, when I was 10 years old, I would have liked to join it, because it was fun to see what they did. But as a child, I didn't realize what it really was, because Hitler Youth meant meetings where everybody was told that Hitler was a hero. He was the one who was going to make Germany great, and he was the one who had given people work, and with that they became prosperous. But also that these young people would die for Hitler. And that was sort of drummed into their brain. And I think this came out later in the war, that the very young ones, they would just fight because for Hitler, for the Führer.
Mm. Your father was very anti your involvement in this, and you weren't even allowed to wear the dress, because you went to a couple of their, you went to a camp, didn't you?
Yes,
and,
yes.
I was reading it and I thought, you've painted a clear picture here, that, and it will be very easy to put in lots of bias and things like that, but you just told the story. And I thought it was quite chilling, the fact that they would sit around and sing Hitler's songs. And,
yes,
and do such honest things, that you were making things for soldiers and
that's
stuff
right.
like that.
Oh yes, it was. There was a lot of good done too. I know everybody is against Hitler, but the Hitler Youth, there was no crime amongst the young ones, because they were all occupied. Mm. And at the meetings, they used to make things and collect things for old people. They used to help old people and poor people. They used to go and collect coal and bring it to them if they couldn't go themselves. Collect books, mm-hmm. particularly books to send to people who spoke German, like in Poland. There were sure. colonies of German people, and books were sent there. And I did join once a camping weekend. I so much wanted to see what it was like, because, don't forget, all my friends at school mm-hmm. used to come back after the weekend and tell me what they've done. Mm-hmm. And I always felt a bit lost because I couldn't join mm-hmm. in that part. So I went for the camp, and it was fun, because in the evening we sat round the campfire. It was like a girl guide, I would have thought.
Yes.
And
the
games uniform. They played, except that you always had to have certain lectures. Everybody knew all the dates about Hitler. Hitler was born on the 20th of April in Braunau am Inn, and that was sort of drummed into everybody. You knew all about Hitler and Göring and Himmler and Goebbels, and like I said before, you see, you had to learn that.
There was this brainwashing that went on.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I think this is what it was, and that's why my father just wouldn't let us join, because we didn't have to. Being Swiss, you could just say no, and that was that. Mm-hmm. And he didn't really like me to say Heil Hitler, but that was something which was very difficult, particularly at school, because the teacher used to enter the class, stand in front of the class, everybody had to get up, and he or she would just say Heil Hitler, and then everybody lifted their hands up and said Heil Hitler. But that was just as if you went into a class and said good morning, and they would all get up and say good morning, because the general greeting was Heil Hitler. There was no good morning, no good afternoon. If you met somebody in the road, you said Heil Hitler, and that was it.
You mentioned this, was this about 1934 when Hitler came to power as Chancellor?
Yes, 33.
Mm. You said that virtually overnight, the greeting of Guten Tag or something, it disappeared.
Yes. You were just told this was finished now, and you just say Heil Hitler, and that was it, and everybody accepted it.
Really, it's interesting because, as you mentioned, the part where you were in East Prussia was right off to the east, as probably not as affected by central government planning as most sort of away from
I think it was, because
was it really?
Oh yes, because you see, you had what was called a Gauleiter.
Oh yes,
everybody
of
did.
Mr.
Everybody
Koch,
had Koch, Erich Koch.
Erich Koch, that's
Erich
right.
Erich Koch. Oh yes, you had to have a Gauleiter, and you had DSS and you had DSR. You did have all that, but the people were I think a little bit different. They were more they took longer to be convinced. And in East Prussia, you have the very big farms, the Junkers and the sort of von Hagen and von Schleswig and so on, you know. And these people were the old army people from the First World War. They weren't all that convinced, but they went along, because if not, they would have lost their property or something like that. There was always the fright that that might happen. So if you just kept quiet, that was fine.
Yeah. Yes, I was quite surprised, because having read your book, the observations on it, and other books I've read, it all seemed to happen terribly quickly. And Hitler rose to power and was there. And it seemed to be accepted very quickly.
Yes, he was.
Yes, I suppose it was just a set of circumstances, rather like knocking dominoes over, where things fell into place.
Yes, also because Hindenburg died, because Hindenburg was actually the one who was the president, and Hitler was only the chancellor. And then the moment Hindenburg died, he stepped up. Mm-hmm. That's all it was. And of course he had organized, I think, certain groups everywhere already, so they could take over. And that was that.
Yes.
And then, of course, everything started to roll. I mean, Jewish people just disappeared, and people didn't seem to question it. It always surprised me that they didn't. But then we didn't have a lot of Jewish people in Königsberg, where we lived. There were hardly any. Jewish people usually sort of concentrated in certain groups in certain towns. Berlin had a lot, being the capital of East of Germany, of course. But we didn't have many.
No. Tell me, when this developed, 1933, 34, 35, I think it was 1934, 35, when Hitler visited Königsberg?
No, I'm sorry, but it was 1938, because I was 14 years old.
Ah, right, okay. I knew it was before...
Before the war.
Before the war.
Yes.
So there you were, your whole town was done up with bunting. And your father refused to have the German flags hanging
from
the front
swastika.
Of the house.
Well, swastika. He wasn't going to have the swastika hanging out of his window, you see.
No.
And the SS turned up and they even were going to lend us one, because they thought maybe we couldn't afford it or hadn't got one or something like that. But my mother just said, look, we are Swiss, and the only flag we are going to put out of the window is probably only the Swiss flag.
Right.
Because they didn't want that. But we weren't in the center of the town. It was sort of, we lived outside, and in the end they just didn't bother. They just left it. Although everybody else had flags out, ours just didn't.
And your music teacher was due to come round.
Oh yes, no.
And she wouldn't make the visit because it was too crowded.
It was, well, she lived in the centre of the town actually, and she said she daren't get out of the house because she had a little dog. She was afraid to leave the dog alone because that dog would bark all the time because of crowds of people outside her window. So I had to go and have my lesson. I had to just go and see her. I could have skipped it, but then, like all children, you don't want to have a double lesson the next week. I rather thought I'd get it all over because I wasn't very keen on all the practice, and it was just my mother's idea that I would have piano lessons. And when I got there, she made it very short, actually, the teacher. She said, look, there's all these crowds outside. You better get home, you know, because you have difficulties. The trams weren't going on that day. Now, the Hitler Youth were lining the roads and people standing behind it. And when I got out of her house, on the corner, there was a woman selling some flowers, little violets. And my father, because I haven't mentioned that before, my father only came home for the weekend because he had a dairy, well, actually, he had three dairies, in Tilsit by the Lithuanian border. And he was there during the week and only would come home for the weekend. But I thought, I'd buy these flowers because he was coming home for the weekend. Well, then I tried to cross the road, and this was very difficult because the crowds, they just wouldn't let me through. They thought I wanted to get in the front to see Hitler. Well, I was a tough little girl, and I just pushed through. And when I got to the front, I noticed the boys standing there, you see, so I just pushed them to the side, and I looked around, and the road was, of course, empty, and I thought, this is my chance. I just get across the road, because I had to go along the side streets to get home. And I pushed through and I jumped into the road, and I'm afraid at that particular moment Hitler came round the corner in the car. He stood up, and two SS men jumped off because they saw me, and I had these flowers in my hand, so they thought that I intended to give these flowers to Hitler. And they approached me, and then one of them sort of took my hand and says, come on in, you can give the Führer your flowers. So I said, but they're not really for him, you know, they're for my father. But of course, he didn't take any notice of it. I mean, he couldn't let me go now, and, you know, that was impossible. I just had to go. So he pulled me along, and I was so afraid. I'm afraid my arm just came up, and Hitler bent down, he took my flowers, and he looked at me. And I thought, oh dear, he's got very cold eyes. And there was no warmth in his face. I've never forgotten that. It sort of went, a shiver went down my back, and I thought, no, I don't know. You might be a big man, but you're not a warm man. And he took my flowers, and then he said to me, but you're not in uniform. So I said, well, I'm not German, I'm Swiss, and I don't belong to the Hitler Youth. Because, you see, everybody, like I said before, had to join the Hitler Youth, and then they had the uniform on. I don't really know whether he heard me, because the people were just shouting and screaming and so on. And I didn't know what to do, and then the SS man just took my hand, and he said, come on then, you've given your flowers to the Führer, to run off, you see. So I got home, and when I got home and I told my parents about it, my father was actually very cross, because he said, I do hope nobody's taken a photograph of that, because I don't want that to be in the paper. We are Swiss and we are guests in this country. He always stressed that we were guests in this country, and we just had to try and keep quiet, because he didn't want any trouble. He didn't want to lose his business or anything.
No.
But I must say, he was lucky it wasn't in the paper, so it was all right. But all my school friends were rather jealous when I came to school the next day. They all said, now you were able to give Hitler those flowers, and you don't even say Heil Hitler in school. You don't join the Hitler Youth, and then you go and give flowers to Hitler. I said, well, look, it was an accident. I didn't intend to do that. Oh, but they didn't believe me.
They didn't do. No, they wouldn't accept it. Listen, can you stay with us some more? Because I'd like to keep talking to you. It's very interesting.
Right.
It's a chunk of history that we're obviously dedicated this whole weekend to in various programmes, not only on this station, but across the media. So if you could, that'll be marvellous.
Nightline with Mike Allen on LBC News Talk 97.3 FM. Give Mike a call on 071 973 9733.
With me in the studio, talking about her book, Helga, the true story of a young woman's flight as a refugee and how she reunited her war-scattered family as Helga Jihadi. Now, I was talking with Helga whilst the news break was on, and I mentioned a story I'd seen in today's press about children at the Imperial War Museum, not quite sure about the D-Day landings, were the British fighting the Germans or were they fighting the French? You know, a certain amount of confusion there. And I thought it was particularly pertinent this weekend for you to join us, because obviously people are talking about the D-Day landings, but you were at the other side of that war, weren't you? You
yes,
were on
indeed.
The east border, mm. and you saw the troops massing and going through your part of the country as the Russian front built up. And obviously, when it all fell apart, they were coming back. So you saw them coming back. And later on, and I'm skipping a few years here, I realise that, you developed your interest in medicine and helped them. But what about those years from the start of the war? Did you feel from sort of 39 on, 1940, that anything was happening? Or did it just seem
well,
like
a
phony
war
to you?
I think in 39, because that was when the Germans marched into Poland.
Yeah.
And that was next door to us. And we knew it was going to happen because Königsberg, being the capital of East Prussia, was suddenly full of soldiers and troops and all sorts of things. And you just realized something is going to happen any minute now, because we never had all these soldiers there, and then suddenly they had all gone.
Mm.
And of course it was what we call a blitzkrieg, a very quick war for Poland. And when that was finished, things became quiet in East Prussia, because the next war, of course, was France, and then the Germans marched into Greece, and there was even Norway. Well, that was all in the western part, yes. It
yes.
was more quiet in the eastern part until the Russian war started.
Mm.
And then, of course, we heard more. But I must say, we never had any bombing until the end of the war, because that's when I think the planes were developed that could carry more fuel.
Yes.
And it's where the English and Americans who used to come and bomb Königsberg. The Russians never did. They never bombed any towns, only where they were fighting. But whilst the Germans were really far into Russia, I mean, they got as far as Stalingrad.
Yeah.
No, they never bombed us. But then, of course, the war turned, and the Russians gradually pushed the Germans back. And really, when we talk about the war, I think it's hardly ever mentioned. When I say the Allied included the Russian army.
Yes.
And I think one mustn't forget how, although the Russians were very cruel to the civilian people, they themselves suffered an awful lot. And if they hadn't helped with the other side, breaking the German army up into two groups, I don't think the war would have finished so quickly, because the Germans were absolutely surrounded, weren't they?
Yes, absolutely. It was very interesting that Japan entered the war against America, having signed a non-aggression pact with Russia.
Yes, but they all signed non-aggression pacts. I mean, Germany signed a non-aggression pact with Russia and just marched in the end, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
It's just a piece of paper, I suppose. Mm. And I mean, even, I don't want to go into today, but, you know, lots of things are just on paper. But when it is necessary, it gets forgotten.
Were you surprised that the German army was going to Russia when you realised that was happening?
I think Hitler had a certain way to build it up. Now, the reason why he went into Poland, for example, was he told everybody that there was the Polish corridor and a lot of Germans lived in there. And, of course, he kept on saying that these Germans suffered under the Poles. Whether it was true or not, I don't know. But that was the reason why he marched into Poland. Well, then, we mustn't forget that the Russians walked into Poland from the other side, didn't they? And Russia and Germany divided Poland between themselves. Well, Hitler wanted that part too. He kept on saying, there are Germans and we must help them. Must free them. He had to have some kind of excuse also for the German people, because otherwise they wouldn't have fought so well. So I don't think people were all that surprised when he got into Russia. But of course he had hoped in a year or two to finish it. He didn't reckon that the German soldiers would still be there in the Russian winter.
Mm.
And I mean, they are shocking winters. They're terrible.
Yes, in fact, anyone from this part of Europe, Western Europe, who thinks they've seen a bad winter should go over there, because it's quite frightening when you see that much snow. When all this was going on, your family was continuing, you were going to school, and I got the feeling from your book, you know, that this seemed to be a backdrop, almost. I'm not saying it struck me as a circus coming to town, but it's almost as if all this stuff was happening in the background, but family life was continuing. And that's something which I haven't noticed in other books about countries at war, this sort of continuity. And there was something rather reassuring about that. Did that strike you at the time, or looking back on it, did you feel that there was some warmth about that continuity?
No, I don't think it struck me at the time, because if you're a child and you grow up, you expect to have an ordinary family life.
Mm.
It wasn't ordinary because, you see, when I got a bit older, 16, 17, all my boyfriends from the school, which was next door to us, they were already called up into the army.
Mm.
And, I mean, some of them already died at 17, others was 18. That was terrible. It really was.
Mm.
You used to get a letter. I was very good at letter writing, so I had quite a number of them, number of boyfriends, and used to write to them. Well, the letter would be returned to me, and it said on the top, "Gefallen für Groß Deutschland," which means "killed for Great Germany." And to get these letters again and again, you had to be very strong in a way. They upset me very much. I used to have a box and put them in there with a picture. And sometimes I used to say a little prayer. That was terrible. They were too young.
Mm.
They were too young to die. So although you said it was a normal family life, yes, it was, but these boys, they had to go.
Yes. Yes, it just struck me as this odd bedfellows, young men going off, and one of your boyfriends said to you, I recall in the book, that he was 19, wasn't he? I think.
Yes.
He said, "I won't see you again." And this is the one who got stung deliberately.
Yes.
So he could steal a kiss.
Yes.
And they knew, I suppose, a lot of young
men. A lot of them
really
knew.
And
they knew they wouldn't get back anymore. Some of them were quite happy to go because, like I said, they'd been so brought up that they had to fight for a greater Germany. But others went, and they had no choice.
Mm.
They just had to go.
Now, like a lot of people, not German nationals, living on German territory, you had a visit from the SS, one of several. So when these chaps arrived, were they dressed in... Because whenever we see SS people on films, we tend to think they're wearing the black leather overcoats and this and the other. What did they look like in truth?
Yes, they do.
They were wearing
they were in uniform.
A bit like hair flicking, that hello, hello thing.
Yeah, well,
maybe not.
It was a grey uniform, actually.
Yeah.
You know, the SS had a grey uniform.
Yeah.
The black one is the civilian one, what I call the grey is the army one. There were two different types of SS, because they had also fighting SS on the front, particularly where the German troops were a little bit weak. They used to put the SS in, and they sort of used to push them. But we had the visits because, my father having several dairies, of course, we weren't all that short on food. My mother became quite good on the black market, actually. Well, you have to try. We were four children, and she soon knew how to exchange food for clothes or for something else. And I have a feeling, as maybe a neighbor had mentioned it or something, but suddenly we had these visits. They just knocked on the door and said I wanted to see my mother, or actually my father, and my mother came and said my father wasn't there. They said, "I'm afraid we have to search the house for any ammunition or papers." We had one or two that weren't too bad, but most of them were rather sort of on the rough side, particularly the officers. They would just go through, and my father studied, just pulled the drawers out and turned them upside down, so all the papers and everything just fell out. And my mother used to be very much afraid, and if I was at home, She used to call me and just hold my hand. I think she wanted to have somebody there for support. Not that I could support her, but it was just that she wasn't alone for that moment. They even used to open the linen cupboards, and that was the worst, because my mother had a lot of white linen. They just throw them out and kick them up with their black boots, and of course that meant you had to wash them all again. They never found anything, because although we had extra food, after the first time we became quite clever. We used to hide them in the cellar somewhere in the back, and my mother used to make sauerkraut, which is very smelly, and we made a point of any extra bottles of brandy to hide it behind the smelly sauerkraut, and and they wouldn't go down there and have a look. But we had no guns or ammunition, and I doubt whether my father had any papers. I think it was just to annoy us more, because my father wasn't in the army, and they might have been jealous.
Possibly.
Because he still had a car, which he needed, because you couldn't go by train to Tilted, because the train service was mostly only for soldiers to get to the Russian front. And his petrol was less and less, so very often he didn't even come home for the weekend. Sometimes it was 2 or 3 weeks before he could come home, because it was difficult.
You must have felt a bit vulnerable then. Because
well, and my mother was always alone with four children. She was the one, I think, who had the great responsibility to see that we all went to school, and like I said, it was about the food and the house. And although we had help, we had one or two Polish girls at first. Some of them didn't quite work out all right.
No, I thought it was very funny because
very primitive.
One of them had never seen a water closet,
no.
A loo before, and you described beautifully. I won't mention it because of it. I know people read the book and they'll be delighted at the description of someone responding to that. And my father spent a lot of time in Germany after the war in Berlin, and he described similar things to me. So it was almost like having him sitting next to me
and telling you about
yes, because yes. It's so similar, yeah. So similar.
But we had a very nice Russian girl in the end, Sasha, and when she realized that we were Swiss, she really took to us, and she was very, very good, and she did anything for us, and she always said that we shouldn't be afraid from the Russians when they would come, because she would stand up for us. But she was taken away from us before the end of the war, because suddenly when the Russians came into East Prussia already, there were then the Germans decided to build, ditches, so that the tanks wouldn't get through.
Tank traps, yes.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. But you didn't have too much protection then, did you? Because around 44 or 45, a lot of the Eastern Front forces have been pulled over to
that's
the west.
Right.
Because the word was around that there would be an invasion. They just weren't sure where.
Oh, yes.
So all this was building up on the west. We were getting ready for D-Day in Western Europe. And you were facing a very, very long walk, weren't you?
Yes.
Tell us about that walk, because your father and mother, the family just went everywhere.
Well, we went together at the particular moment when we realized how far the Russians had come. I was a medical student, but the university was bombed out. So we had to just work in the hospitals to look after the wounded. And one of my duties was to be on station duty, and the trains used to come in with wounded, just in cattle trucks thrown in. With that, we realized these wounded hadn't come very far. We had 10, 15 degrees below zero. Half of them were already dead, but not from their wounds. They were frozen.
Good God.
And it was my job at 18 to sort those out. But the ones who were alive warned us. We were young nurses, and they said, look, the news you're getting on the radio is not true. You ought to try and go. We said, well, why? And they described some of the atrocities the Russians committed on the civilian population, because they had reconquered parts which had been taken by the Russians. And they warned us and said we ought to go. Well, I did leave. Before I left, actually, before my mother was evacuated, she gave me a little phial of cyanide. And she said, if ever I have to leave, and she wasn't there, she trusted me to use it if I felt I needed it. And that was my talisman. I carried it around my neck. I left Königsberg beginning of January 1945 because of the warnings we had. And I wrote about it in my book, and the picture in the front of it where you see the refugee track and there's sort of a person in the back, that could have been me. We just walked. And like I said, it was very cold, 10, 15 degrees below zero. We had no warmth, we had no shelter. We didn't even have food at times.
And weren't the Russian planes coming down on the convoys? And
they did. We had to cross what we call the Huff. That was the only way they surrounded us. And the only way we could get out was cross this Huff to get to a small strip of land, which we called the Nerung. And they knew we were refugees because they could see the tracks, horses and carts. And they started to shoot at us. And of course, if the ice breaks, the horses and carts just disappear. You couldn't help them because it only takes a few minutes and you're dead. It's too cold. I was fortunate. I had joined up with two soldiers, although they were both not very well, and we helped one another, and I did break through the ice once, but they pulled me out. I think the time when I remember it was the hunger wasn't the worst. Do you know, even if you're hungry, after time, those hunger pangs go. You don't feel hungry anymore, but you get weak. But the cold, all the cold, you find suddenly that your clothes seem to go away from your body, and there's a space, and you shiver. And even talking about it now, I feel cold.
Sure, I hear it in your voice.
I never want to be cold again. I don't mind going without food, but I don't want to be cold again. I've never forgotten that. That was a very hard time, and I finished up passing through parts also where the Russians had been, and I do write about it. There's a chapter called The Village of Hell, but I've never talked about it, and I haven't even told everything in that chapter. It was horrible what the Russians did, and it wouldn't have mattered that I was Swiss. They did it to the, you know, they just did it to the people, because in the track, do you know, we even had French prisoners of war, because you see, after the French war, the prisoners were sent into prisoner camps to East Prussia to be as far away from France as possible, and there were put out on the farms to help on farms. When the Russians came near, these prisoners went with the women from these farms and helped them with their horses and their tracks. And it wouldn't have made any difference to the Russians whether they're French or Germans. They just killed everything and everybody.
So that journey, when you travelled almost one end of the country to the other, it was almost, wasn't it?
Well, I've got as far as Greifswald,
yes.
And I found my mother there. I finished up in hospital, actually, and they had to burn my clothes because there was nothing left except rags. I was very ill. I nearly died.
When your mother came to see you in hospital...
Oh, I couldn't believe it.
I rather got the impression, I mean, you didn't write that, but I rather got the impression from reading it that you thought perhaps you maybe had died and here was an angel.
Because yes, it was a dream.
You just couldn't believe it, that here eventually was your mother.
But we had always had that address of friends of ours, and we said if anything happened, we would try and get as far as Greifswald and see whether we could meet. But I was still afraid that the Russians would come there, so I persuaded my mother to leave Greifswald. We got onto a lorry, actually, which was going to Hamburg. And I'm afraid this time it was an English Spitfire that shot at us. But we jumped off. But the moment I heard it, I remembered the Russians, and I just said to my mother, off, you know, and we pushed off, and we jumped out before the lorry blew up. And we stayed at local farm then until the end of the war. Mm. I found my father by going to Hamburg, and that was a miracle, an absolute miracle.
Because the chances of meeting somebody is very, very slim.
He sat in a road. I just found him.
Amazing. Did you have a feeling that you were walking in the right direction? Do you know how sometimes people do something, they say, well, I don't know why.
I just wanted to get away from the Russians because I'd seen something which I just couldn't get over. No. I just went to Hamburg that day because the Red Cross had opened up a station where you could go and put your name down, and they were going to look for your relatives, and people queued up there for days. And although we had a curfew and Hamburg was occupied by the English, they didn't mind if you even sat there during the night, because you see, once you lost your place in the queue, you would have to go to the back again. And it took about 2 or 3 days, you know, before you got to the door to sign your name. And there were so many, thousands of people queuing up. And I walked along this queue to get to the end when I suddenly saw this old man, and he got hold of my skirt and pulled it. And he just said, I had a daughter once. Actually, I had three daughters, but one looked just like you. And there was a woman next to him, and she said, look, Granddad, don't do that. You keep on doing that to the girls. It's not your daughter. You lost your daughter. But he hadn't. It was my father. I recognized him suddenly, although he looked awful. You know, he was unshaven. He had gray hair. He was thin. But it was him. And I never forget, he wanted to do a kindness. And he gave me a piece of dry bread. Oh. He thought I might be hungry. But we had been on the farm, my mother and I, and we had quite good food. And I didn't take it. I said, no, Papa, you don't have to give that to me. You can keep it. I've got food. But that was all he had, just a piece of bread, and he thought he could give it to me. He still had his car, actually, which he had hidden with some people. And today I have to laugh about the little story, because we were trying to get this car out of Hamburg. But the English occupation forces, of course, wouldn't allow you to drive a car. If you could drive a car, you know, they took it because they needed cars. So my father did something on the engine, and he bought an old horse. And the horse pulled this car. And we were trying to get back to the farm where my mother and I stayed, but we never made it because this old horse just, well, he was much too weak to pull it. And we finished up in a little village called Kiesdorf, and the burgomaster said, do you know there is an empty radio station on top of the hill? All the equipment is smashed up, but there are barracks. Why don't you move into there? You got some kind of, got a roof over your head at least, because otherwise it meant going into a refugee camp. So we did. That old horse pulled that car up into this radio station. There was a fence around it, and we could let that horse sort of loose after that. But I'm afraid there was nothing there on the radio station. You know, it was just empty barracks. But the English occupation forces gave us some palliasses. We said we are Swiss, and you know, they're really quite good. They tried to help us. They gave us sort of a bit of china and a saucepan. We had a well outside for water, a little shed in the back with a bucket. But we had a roof off our head. We didn't have to go into a refugee camp. We exchanged the horse for a bike. And the moment this bike appeared, it was my mother's idea that now I should do the journey from Hamburg to Mainburg, which is near Munich, to look for my sister, who was married there, because she didn't feel that she would have moved, because that part was occupied by the Americans, and, I mean, nobody would go. It was only the Russian part.
Do you know, you've captivated me with your story. You've captivated me with your book. There is a lot more that people will learn from the book, and time has taken us up against the wall. So let me tell people they can buy it at W.H. Smith's. It's called Helga, the true story of a young woman's flight as a refugee and how she reunited her war-scattered family. My guest has been Helga Jihadi. Thank you very much, Helga, for being with us. It's £6.99, published by Verona, and this is the International Standard Book Number. It's 0952 19 3302, and it's called Simply Helga, and you get it at WH6 Smith's, and it's just £6.99. Thank you very much for being with us. I think you must work in a different time span to me. It's gone so very quickly. Thank you very much. Bless you.
Thank you.